Hey, good evening, everyone. Welcome to our ninth installment of Great Rivalries of Jewish History. Today, we get much more modern. And we open up on August 26th, 1903. We are in Basel, Switzerland, at the Sixth Zionist Congress, where Theodor Herzl has just made a proposal. And the proposal is for a homeland for the Jewish people in Uganda. Okay? Now, mind you, August 26, 1903, something very significant happened in the Jewish world just a few months earlier. Anyone remember? Kishinev, the Kishinev massacre, the Kishinev pogrom on April 20th and April 21st of 1903, right around Pesach time, as it oftentimes happens. Kishinev, of course, is in Russia, was a shock to many Russian Jews and really around the world, who felt that that type of massacre and that type of pogrom was from the 19th century, that type of thing would never again happen, certainly not in the more educated, in the enlightened century that was supposed to be the 20th century. And all of a sudden we find ourselves in the 20th century, 1903, and lo and behold, the Jews are once again being massacred. Not only are they being massacred, but they are being massacred, according to most accounts, with at least the permission of, or certainly with the permission of, the Russian authorities, right? Whether they were turning a blind eye, whether they were actively permissive of it, but nonetheless, it was allowed to happen. Not only that, but this was really the first massacre that took place in an age where newspapers were able to get from one area to another. And so the Western world was privy to the information of that which took place in Kishinev. And it was a real shock and awe to the entire world. After the Kishinev massacres, again, we're in the Sixth Zionist Congress, so there had already been five. Zionism was a movement that was in full force at this point. And the Kishinev massacres lit the fire underneath the leadership of the Zionist movement. At least according to the way Herzl had envisioned Zionism, Zionism was supposed to be an answer to the problem of anti-Semitism. It was supposed to provide a safe haven, a practical safe haven for Jews, certainly the lowly, ghetto-like Jews that were living in Russia, in the Pale of the Settlement. And Herzl realized that it was now or never, that he had to put forth a plan that would either be successful or eventually all of their talk and their rhetoric would crumble when people would no longer take them seriously. And so Herzl proposes the Uganda plan, a homeland for the Jewish people in Africa. And of course it passes. Passes by a vote of 295 to 178. And nonetheless, it is an abject failure. Because who votes against it en masse as a voting bloc? The Russians, the Russian Jews, those who were most affected by Kishinev, they en masse, almost unanimously, vote against the Uganda proposal. And Herzl is beyond himself. He can't understand it. And so as he's walking out of this proposal, he bumps into Chaim Weizmann, who we're going to talk about a lot tonight. And he says to Weizmann the following line: "These people have a rope around their necks, and they still refuse. What's wrong with you guys? I'm trying to help you. What am I not getting that you seem to have going through your minds?" And so as he's walking out, he invites men, and they're having this conversation. They pass by a young woman who screams at Herzl, which is a nice way of saying, in better French than I could have done, despite my 5 years of taking French in high school, "Mr. President, you're a traitor." And Herzl is shaken by that experience, because Herzl realizes just how much of a rift there is between the Western European Jews and the Eastern European Jews, specifically when it comes to the subject of Zionism and when it comes to the subject of an appropriate homeland for the Jewish people. And it's that story that in my mind captures the essence of what we're going to talk about tonight. It's that image of Herzl walking out, not understanding why Russian European Jews, Eastern European Jews, weren't in favor of this. And that young woman screaming at him, "You're a traitor, Herzl." And how hurtful that was to Herzl. And what I want to do tonight is, my goal is, if by the end of the class we understand that one scene just a little bit better, then I will have accomplished my goal. We start off with just a brief history, a timeline. Ooh, that's not going to be so good. I need more lights off, right? Hold on, let me just... Okay, while other lights are turning on. So, again, just a brief history. All of us know these dates. I just want to run through them quickly so we have a baseline of what it is we're talking about. Of course, 1894, we start with the Dreyfus trial. We're going to discuss more about that. I don't need to tell anyone here. 1896, Herzl publishes his work, The Jewish State. I'm not going to try in my German or whatever language that is. 1897, you have the first Zionist Congress. 1901, I just threw that in, JNF. It's our JNF Shabbos this week, so JNF was founded. 1903, you have, again, the Uganda Plan at the Sixth Zionist Congress. Kishinev massacres, the order should have been reversed because the Kishinev came before that. 1914 is you have the First World War. 1916 is when the British and the French divide up what once was the Ottoman Empire. 1917, you have the Balfour Declaration. Again, that's at least a brief run through of the major times that we are going to discuss this evening. We start off with Dr. Theodore Herzl. And what I want to do is I want to give a little bit of a biography of Herzl, followed by a little of biographical information about Weizmann, and then to really get to our main subject this evening, which is where they disagreed, where their rivalry was, what was the essence of their disagreement. Herzl's born, Herzl lives a very short life, right? Herzl only lives 44 years. For those who were in Shul on Shabbos, I spoke about Herzl's death and his eulogy that was given by Rav Kook. Tonight we're going to talk a little bit more about his birth. What's important to know about Herzl is where he's born and where he lives. He lives in Vienna. Vienna, of course, was... we're in Western Europe. Western Europe, which was enlightened. Western European Jews lived dramatically different than Eastern European Jews. Herzl is completely assimilated. He's a writer, he's a playwright, he's a journalist. I didn't quote it here, but Herzl in his diary has a whole paragraph about his family's Christmas tree, just to give you a sense of how assimilated he was. Of course, we all know the famous story that Herzl is the correspondent for an influential Parisian newspaper. And of course, he finds himself as the correspondent during the Dreyfus Affair. Now, it happens to be historically, while we all think that the reason why Herzl wrote his book, The Jewish State, was because of the Dreyfus Affair, historians debate that. And not everyone agrees. That may have been the icing on the cake, but according to many historians, Herzl was already, these were already lingering in his mind, these thoughts, long before the Dreyfus Affair. But we'll go with the more common interpretation, which is that it was the Dreyfus Affair that was the impetus for Herzl's Zionist activity. Little did you know, but on the internet nowadays, you can make your own newspaper article out of any text you give them. And so here you have a newspaper clipping from my computer. No, from the New Free Press. From the Dreyfus trial. Herzl reported the following, talking about Dreyfus. He reached a line of officers who roared at him, "Judas, traitor!" Dreyfus shouted in their direction, "I forbid you to sullen my honor." When he reached a group of journalists, he halted and said, "You must tell all of France that I am innocent." Some replied by vilifying him. The mob outside shouted from time to time, "Death to the traitor!" And again, it's at that point that Herzl realized that there has to be an answer to the Jewish question, that Jewish anti-Semitism wasn't going anywhere, and the most appropriate response was none other than the founding of a Jewish state. Herzl in 1894 had written a book called called The Ghetto, where he regarded the Jewish issue as a social one. After the Dreyfus Affair, he published Der Judenstaat, where the Jewish state... where again, that was really the first major book written about Zionism and really considered the founding work of the Zionist movement. 1897, August I guess, 1831. No? What is that supposed to be? August 29th. August 29th, 1897. So Herzl convenes the first Zionist Congress, and he convenes six more between 1897 and 1903. Okay? At the sixth Zionist Congress, as we talked about, he is called a traitor. He can't understand why Eastern European Jews are not more supportive of his proposal. It's firmly rejected at the seventh Zionist Congress in 1905, but Herzl dies before that in Vienna in 1904. Again, Herzl lives a very short life. From the time that he publishes The Jewish State until his death is only 8 years, which is astounding to think about. When we think about Theodor Herzl as the founder of the Zionist movement, we're really talking about an eight-year period. An eight-year period of just fast-paced, rapid motion of the creation of a Zionist movement. Now, the truth is, before reading an excerpt from his book, the truth is that even though Herzl forms the formalized Zionist movement, really, let's say 1897, what we'll see from Weizmann's books and works is that this was not something new. Herzl was late to the party. Herzl was completely ignorant of all of the grassroots Zionist activities that were taking place long before he came out and wrote The Jewish State. And we'll read later on that Weizmann actually mocks Herzl's book because he says there's nothing new here. We've been saying all of this for years. He's just late to the party. He happens to be able to speak a little bit better than us and articulate a little bit better than us. And he put flowery language on it better than us. But this is nothing new. We've seen this all before. Okay? And again, that's a lot of what's behind this tension between Herzl and Weizmann representing what we'll call the Eastern European Jews. I'll share with you a quick quote that I found was particularly, highlighted a lot of what we're talking about. Herzl writes, "We have honestly endeavored everywhere to integrate ourselves into the social life of our surrounding communities and to preserve only the faith of our fathers. Yet we are not permitted to do so. In vain we are loyal patriots. In vain do we make the same sacrifices of life and property as our fellow citizens. In vain do we strive to increase the fame of our native land in science and art or her wealth by trade and commerce. In countries where we have lived for centuries, we are denounced as strangers." And that's really the Jewish story, right? We've always tried to assimilate, and we've always been rejected. And that's why Herzl comes to the conclusion that we need a place to call our homeland. I'll just share with you lastly, and again, I'm running through some of the biography, because as we get more contemporary, a lot of us, we know these personalities, so we don't have to dwell on it. But I'll just share with you a great quote from Herzl's diary, which to me gives me really makes the hair on my arm stand every time I read a quote like this. And again, very apropos for our JNF Shabbos this coming week. "One day," Herzl wrote in his diary in 1901, "once the Jewish state comes into existence, all this will appear petty and unremarkable." He's talking about a lot of his frustrations and a lot of the pushback. He can't understand why people aren't more supportive. In particular, I think here he's lamenting that there's a lack of rabbinic support for much of his efforts. So he says, all of this is going to be nothing once the Jewish state comes to fruition. Little did he know. "Perhaps a fair-minded historian will find that it was something after all, when an impecunious Jewish journalist, in the midst of the deepest degradation of the Jewish people and at a time of the most disgusting anti-Semitism, made a flag out of a rag and turned a miserable rabble into a people rallying around that flag." And there's a reason why to many Zionists, Herzl was considered a modern-day prophet for quotes like that, where he essentially foretold exactly what Jewish history would look like over the next 47 somewhat years, and really the last 116 years. Come to Chaim Weizmann, who I think we might know a little bit less, and to me is honestly much more of the fascinating personality here. Because Weizmann has a totally different approach, a totally different upbringing than Herzl. Weizmann is born in Motul, Russia in 1874. He is born to a very traditional family. I believe he was one of 15 children. In fact, it was so poor that all of this about Weizmann, by the way, is from his autobiography. Anyone here read his autobiography? Okay. Everyone tonight, let's start with this. Anyone who considers themselves a Zionist or is fascinated by modern Israeli history must read his autobiography. It is in some ways horrifically boring, but in so many other ways, it is absolutely, no, it really, it's fascinating. It's fascinating because you'll see his life spans the totality. He was on the front lines of so much of what, you know, we know, and he displays it, he tells it over with such raw emotion. And it really, someone gave it to me. I've read it a few times now. It's absolutely fantastic, and I found it very, very interesting. He lived in a completely, totally impoverished upbringing. There weren't roads. There wasn't access to the outside world. There wasn't newspapers. His father, and they were relatively well-to-do in their community. His father did something with lumber. I believe he was in charge of sending it down the river. And he would be gone for months on end. And he, in fact, describes the feeling, because I guess they used to do it during a specific season that culminated Pesach time. And depending on how the rain was that year, you know, and how the rivers were flowing, his father would either come home right before or right after Pesach. And he discussed the euphoria that would take place in their household when his father would come home right before Pesach, again, not having seen the family for months, exhausted from laborious work, and to be able to now sit with his children at the Seder night. And it was really, it was almost, you know, again, for my generation, for me, who Judaism was handed on a silver platter and we live in relative affluence, thank God, reading about his upbringing was just, it was shocking, honestly. No roads, no electric. I mean, it was really, it's fascinating just to read that. Nonetheless, he went to Cheder, did not have a very positive experience in Cheder, travels to Pinsk, where he's going to go to school. Pinsk, obviously, was much more of an enlightened neighborhood, was on pace with Warsaw and Vilna and other major, I'm sorry, Warsaw and other major areas that we're familiar with. And he has an immediate draw towards science. And obviously, that's going to play a significant factor in his role as a Zionist. But that's also going to be filled with tension throughout his life. Weizmann, in his autobiography, describes numerous times that he's constantly pulled between his scientific endeavors and his Zionistic endeavors. Okay? Not everyone had that, but he had a tremendous passion for both of them. And it's that passion for science which takes him all over the world. Takes him to Pinsk, to Germany, where he gets his doctorate. He goes to Geneva, and eventually, after Geneva, and I put that on purpose, he goes to exile in Manchester. Now, why do I say exile in Manchester? Manchester at the time was not considered a major hub of Zionistic activity. All of that was taking place in Germany, in Switzerland, in areas like that. It was not taking place in Budapest. It was not taking place in Manchester. Part of Weizmann's mazel, so to speak, was that he found himself in the right place at the right time. Because it's in Manchester that he finds himself during World War I. Now that's interesting for a number of things. Number one is World War I, in a simplistic fashion, is really the Turks and the Germans against the Allied forces, which included the United States, Great Britain, France, Russia, Italy, etc. Okay? Now the reason what that makes that so important for us is that the Ottomans, of course, the Turks were in charge of Israel at the time. And so when the Turks lose World War I and it falls into the hand of the British and the French, the fact that Weizmann is in Britain is going to play a significant role. The wisdom of this, or I'll say the luck of it, or the foresight of all of this, is that when Weizmann comes to Manchester and he makes relationships with significant people, first he meets the editor of the Manchester Guardian, a man by the name of G.P. Scott. And G.P. Scott introduces him to two significant individuals, and one by the name of Herbert Samuel, and the other by the name of Lloyd George, who, of course, are significant people in the British Empire, in the British government. The fact that Weizmann now has that connection is going to prove priceless. Not only that, but when everyone is deciding who to align themselves with, and everyone's running after the Turks, or everyone is saying we should remain neutral because we don't know who's going to win World War I, and maybe if the Turks and the Germans win World War I, we don't want to have perceived as siding with the Allied forces. We'll never get a homeland. And everyone says you should be neutral, don't pick sides. Weizmann chose sides. He aligned himself with the British, and people thought he was crazy. People thought it was a kamikaze mission. But Weizmann knew that were the British to win, he would be in a unique position to influence the British government on behalf of the Jewish people. That was lucky strike number one. Lucky strike number two was that the fact that Weizmann is a scientist, we all know this, he created the Weizmann organism, acetone, which was extremely beneficial to the British during World War I and helping them make gunpowder. In fact, that's how he met Churchill. That's how he got him access to a lot of these diplomats, to a lot of these British officials, was they called him in. They needed him to adapt the Weizmann organism for their war purposes, to be able to produce it on a mass level. The fact that Weizmann was able to do that, again, it's all about access at that point. I realize now none of you are going to be able to read this. But I'll do my best. Of course, we know most famously, Weizmann had an interaction with an individual by the name of Lord Balfour. Okay? Famously from our Balfour Declaration. Now, Lord Balfour and Weizmann had a very different interpretation of their first meeting, shall we say. Okay? I'll read it to you. I looked at my listener. This is Weizmann in his autobiography describing his meeting with Balfour. He says, I looked at my listener and suddenly became afraid that this appearance of interest in courtesy might be nothing more than a mask. I remember that I was sweating blood and tried to find some less ponderous way of expressing myself. I was ready to bow myself out of the room, but Balfour held me back and put some questions to me regarding the growth of the movement. He had heard of Dr. Hertz, a very distinguished leader. Obviously, he didn't know Herzl's name, which, keep that in mind. Just keep that in mind, that Weizmann takes a shot that Balfour didn't know Herzl's name, which is, just keep that in your mind. A very distinguished leader had found and organized it. I ventured to correct him, pointing out that Herzl had indeed placed the movement on new footing and had given a tradition a modern political setting. But Herzl had died young, and he had left us this legacy of Uganda, which we were trying to liquidate. Right? Because again, Weizmann wants Palestine. He doesn't want Uganda. Then suddenly I said to Mr. Balfour, very famous quote, supposing I were to offer you Paris instead of London, would you take it? He sat up, looked at me and answered, but Dr. Weizmann, we have London. That is true, I said, but we had Jerusalem when London was a marsh. He leaned back, continued to stare at me and said two things which I remember vividly. The first was, are there many Jews who think like you? I answered, I believe I speak the mind of millions of Jews whom you will never see and cannot speak for themselves, but with whom I could pave the streets of the country I come from. To this he said, if that is so, you will one day be a fourth. Shortly before I withdrew, Balfour said, it is curious. The Jews I meet are quite different. I answered, Mr. Balfour, you meet the wrong kind of Jews. Okay? He writes elsewhere that the meeting did not go as well as he planned, that Balfour and his autobiographer, his memoirs, had a very different interpretation of how the meeting went than Weizmann did. Nonetheless, we all know that in 1917, November 2nd, 3rd, 4th, early November, someone could Google it, 2nd, right, 2nd, okay, I was right. November 2nd, 1917, the British signed suggest the Balfour Declaration. You have it here. Again, I'll read it to you. Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you on behalf of His Majesty's government the following declaration of sympathy with the Jewish Zionist aspirations. ... On the side, you have again from Weizmann's autobiography what was happening as the British were ratifying the Balfour Declaration. He writes, while the cabinet was in session, approving the final text, I was waiting outside, this time within call. Sykes brought the document out to me with the explanation, Dr. Weizmann, it's a boy. Well, I did not like the boy at first. He was not the one I had expected. Weizmann, of course, was shooting for a lot more than what the Balfour Declaration had suggested. But I knew that this was a great departure. I telephoned my wife and went to see Achad Ha'am, who was Weizmann's mentor in many regards. Okay? So again, Weizmann actually, interestingly enough, he was on the front lines of every moment of Jewish history except for one. Anyone know which one? No? No. The first Zionist Congress. Weizmann gets stuck in traffic, so to speak. He had travel problems and he didn't make it there on time. And he writes in his autobiography that he forever viewed that as a mark on his legacy. That he was not at the first Zionist Congress. But you see, he's on the front lines of all of this. We're not going to read through all of this. When I give out the packets at the end, you can go through. Again, he's appointed on a commission to Palestine to advise the British about the future development of the country. This is where he lays the groundwork, actually, for Hebrew University. Of course, Weizmann was the driving force, believed that there needed to be a university. Every country needs a university. And he was the big proponent of that. If you remember from our Rav Kook class a few weeks ago, we spoke about Rav Kook's speech at the opening of Hebrew University. And again, he ultimately becomes the very first president of the State of Israel from 1948 to 1952, at which point he dies. Weizmann and Truman. Anyone read the David McCullough book, Truman? Oh my goodness, okay. Right after you go home tonight and read Trial and Error, which is Weizmann's autobiography, you're going to go home and you're going to read Truman's, the David McCullough biography of Truman. It's like 900 pages. So even if you don't want to read the whole thing, read the part about the founding of the State of Israel. You will cry. It's amazing. It's amazing to read the behind the scenes. I'll put it this way. If you're faith in God's divine providence in the founding of the State of Israel needed reinforcement, read the Truman biography, because you get a sense that it was by no means a done deal. Truman hated the Zionist issue. Let's make that very clear. First of all, Truman had many anti-Semitic comments because he probably never met a Jew growing up in Missouri. Little other factoid. Anyone who ever comes into my office, anyone been in my office? A couple of you. You'll notice there's a picture on my wall. Picture on the wall is a picture of my grandfather with Harry Truman. My great-grandfather was a rabbi in Missouri, and he knew Harry Truman from there. And there were actually two pictures. One is from when Truman was president, and that was a picture that my family had, and when my grandparents passed away, disappeared, similar to Tom Brady's football jersey from the other night. We have no idea where it went, but... So I was devastated because I wanted some documentation of their relationship. So I Googled Abraham Danzig, Rabbi Abraham Danzig, who, by the way, from the Chai Adam lineage, we've spoken about in the past also in other venues, and Harry Truman. And sure enough, on the Truman Presidential Library website, they have a picture of my great-grandfather, Harry Truman, and Boxer, I think the other guy's name is. Harry Boxer, I believe his name was, who was the founder of NCSY and the president of the OU. That was a picture, though, taken after Truman was not president anymore, but I have it hanging on my wall nonetheless. Okay, Truman did not like the Zionist issue. And the reason is Truman had his own problems. Right? When was Truman elected president?
He became president of Roosevelt.
Right, so when did Roosevelt die?
45.
So this is 3 years into the presidency. He's getting ready. When was the re-election? 48, right? So he's got a lot going on. And the last thing he needs is this polarizing issue. This is a thorn in his side because it's literally being caught between a rock and a hard place. State Department, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to know where the State Department stood on this issue. They didn't want to, impact the relationship with the Arabs and the Russians. And they didn't want to they didn't want him to get involved. And of course, we know, so Truman does not want to meet with Weizmann. He considers him a nudnik. And we all know the famous story. Weizmann is in America. He's trying to get a meeting with Truman. Truman won't respond to his messages, so to speak. So what do they do? So two individuals, Dewey Stone and Frank Goldman, two friends of Chaim Weizmann, are having dinner one night. And they're in the restaurant in, I think Dewey Stone is telling Frank Goldman the predicament that Weizmann can't get in to meet with the president. And Goldman says, we only have one way of getting into him. It's our dear friend, their mutual friend, Eddie Jacobson. Now, little piece of history you might not know. Back then, they didn't have cell phones. That part of the history you know. But as the story goes, they didn't have enough money to pay for the phone call, the long-distance phone call, to Eddie Jacobson. So they went around the restaurant collecting coins to get enough money to be able to make this phone call. They call Eddie Jacobson. Jacobson gets basically on the next train and goes to meet... Right, he has unfettered access to the West Wing, and he goes to meet with his dear friend, President Harry Truman. And McCullough writes in the book the following. They're sitting in the Oval Office, and and Truman is pushing back. He says, I don't need this. I don't want this. He made him promise, I'll meet you with you on one condition, that is, you don't talk about the Zionist issue. And what does Jacobson do? He talks about the Zionist issue. And Truman's getting upset, so he writes the following. So Jacobson looks back at Truman and writes the following. Harry, I'll read it here so I don't have my back to you. He says, Harry, all my life, there's a sculpture of, which president? One of the presidents. I think Andrew Jackson. Yeah, Andrew Jackson sitting there. So he looks at, he picks this up and he says, Harry, all of your life... You have had a hero. I too have a hero. A man I never met, but who is, I think, the greatest Jew who ever lived. Jacobson didn't know from Weizmann. He was told. Right? He was a showman right now. I'm talking about Chaim Weizmann. He is a very sick man. Almost broken in health, but he traveled thousands of miles just to see you and plead the cause of my people. Now you refuse to see him just because you were insulted by some of our American Jewish leaders. Even though you know that Weizmann had absolutely nothing to do with these insults and would be the last man to party to them. It doesn't sound like you, Harry, because I thought you could take this stuff they have been handing out. As Abba even later wrote, the comparison between Weizmann and Andrew Jackson was unimaginably far-fetched, and it worked. Truman began drumming his fingers on the desk. He wheeled around his chair with his back to Jacobson, sat looking out the window into the garden. For what to Jacobson seemed like centuries, neither of them said anything. Then, swinging about and looking Jacobson in the eye, Truman said what Jacobson later described as the most endearing words he had ever heard. You win, you bald-headed nice person. You like how I crossed that out, just to make this kid friendly, right? I will see him. From the White House, Jacobson walked directly across Lafayette Square and up 16th Street to the bar and at the Statler, where, as never before in his life, he downed two double bourbons. All right, it was a rough day at the office. Okay, so it was by no means, right, that even though Weizmann had all this, he had a great name, etc., it was by no means that he got the meeting with Truman. At the meeting with Truman is where he really laid the groundwork for America supporting the founding of the State of Israel. I'll share with you now a clip from a news report about, this is later, this is after the founding of the State of Israel. And I share with you because you'll hear Weizmann speak and you'll get a sense for the chutzpah that he had. Coming to America for the first time, this is right after the founding of the State of Israel, for the first time as the elected president of the State of Israel. And listen up.
The president of Israel, Dr. Chaim Weizmann, meets America's president, Harry Truman, and gives him a Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament. Later, at Blair House, the official guest house for visiting dignitaries, Dr. Weizmann tells reporters the two major points which he discussed with President Truman.
Once the lifting of the embargo, I have tried to explain to the president that it is essential for us, for our safety, for our fight there in Palestine, that the embargo should be lifted as soon as possible. The other point, which is of equal importance, was the discussion of a loan, not a very big loan, but a medium-sized loan. For American standards, it is probably very small. But we have a tiny country, and for our tiny country, it's quite a considerable chunk of money, something in the nature of $90 to $100 million.
The next day, Dr. Weizmann, after thanking America for its friendship, sails for France. He states regretfully that he is bypassing England, his home, because Britain has failed to recognize Israel. But he voices the Jews' desire to live in friendship with both Britain and the Arabs.
Okay. Up until this point, we've learned about Herzl, we've learned about Weizmann, and now we come to our class. And the class is really about where they converged, where they disagreed. And to me, it is best captured by the following quote by Abba Ibn, which said that Herzl came from the outside, but Weizmann came from the inside. And that to me says it all. Herzl is an outsider to the masses. When we talk about the masses, I'm talking about the Russian, the masses of Eastern European Jews, Russia, etc., who are living in horrific conditions, who have been having Zionist meetings for years, and who viewed Herzl as an outsider, someone who never got them, someone who never understood them. And let's delve a little bit deeper into that. I tried to, I tried to simmer it down, to boil it down to four major categories of what differentiated Herzl from Weizmann. First of all, Herzl was a totally assimilated Jew. Weizmann had a traditional upbringing, steeped in observance. Weizmann understood what made Israel more important than Uganda. Herzl didn't. To Herzl, Zionism was a practical solution. It was a practical solution to the problem of anti-Semitism. It was a practical solution to the problem of the Kishinev massacres. It was a practical solution to the problems that the Jewish people are having of being thrown out of every country. The answer is to get a country of your own. If it could be in Palestine, great. If it couldn't, take it. It's the best you're going to get. To Weizmann, it was Israel or bust. It was Palestine or bust. It wasn't just about a land. It was about a homeland. Number two, Herzl conceives of the idea for a Jewish state on his own. Right? Again, he has the Dreyfus Affair. He realizes there's got to be a better solution for the Jewish people. He writes the Jewish state. It was a relatively new idea for him. It was like the light bulb went off, and again, a flurry of action in eight relatively short years. For Herzl, Herzl understood the Jewish psyche. Zionism was not... Zionism was not something new to him. Zionism was something they spoke about at their Shabbos tables. Zionism was something that when they went to the cafes late at night with a coffee, that's what they were talking about. It was something innate. It was something that was part of their kishkas. It wasn't just a political movement. It was something real to them. It was emotional to them. Okay? Herzl, and this to me is the biggest, most important thing. Herzl believed that the solution for the Jewish people was a political system. Herzl believed that the solution was a political system. What I mean by that is, the answer is in meeting with political dignitaries. Whether it was Russian dignitaries, and Herzl got killed for that. When he met with Von Plev, I don't know how to pronounce that, P-L-E-V-H-E, right? Who was the Russian minister, who many thought was the one behind the Kishinev massacres. And yet, when given the opportunity, Herzl runs to meet with them. And the Russian Jews are incredulous. How can you meet with the guy who's supporting anti-Semitism? Herzl says, I don't care. Any FaceTime I can get with international leaders, I'm going to take. Whether that's Constantinople, whether that's Russia, whether that's Vienna, it doesn't matter. Herzl believes that if you put enough pressure on political dignitaries and political governments, eventually they'll come to a solution. Weizmann fundamentally disagreed. He thought that was entirely naive. He thought it was entirely naive and a waste of time. And he thought Herzl wasn't capitalizing on the movement, on the masses, on a groundswell of people, that for them this wasn't just another thing, this was the thing. In fact, anyone familiar with the name Max Nordau? So Max Nordau, again, was considered one of the great Zionist leaders. Gave a fiery speech at all the Zionist Congress. And he was from the Western European... community. Herzl blasts him in his autobiography. Weizmann blasts him in his autobiography. And the reason why he blasts him is he says, Max Nordau is a Zionist once a year. He comes, he gives a speech, and he leaves. It might be good speeches, but he says, for us, this isn't a once a year issue. This is our essence. There's no, right? Remember I spoke about the tension between his scientific endeavors and his Zionist. There was a constant tension because they were each part of him. He viewed the Western European Jews as outsiders, as totally naive in their approach to answering this question. And again, lastly, when Herzl starts, he's completely ignorant. He doesn't realize that this has been going on for years, whereas Weizmann worked within the framework of existing Jewish organizations. Weizmann was part of the people. Herzl was always an outsider. And to me, I tried to find two quotes which in my mind captured the essence of this difference, and I quote for you the following. Number one is Herzl. Herzl in response to Weizmann. I'm trying to remember the circumstances. I believe it was when Sir Francis Montefiore. Sir Francis Montefiore was the nephew of Moses Montefiore. And Sir Francis Montefiore was, it's a derogatory term, but I'll use it anyways, and you'll forgive me. But he was like a tool. And what I mean by that is, he wasn't very well represented by the masses of the Zionist movement. They didn't like him very much. And at the end, Herzl's telling Weizmann to basically back off. They want to appoint Francis Montefiore as a vice president of the Zionist movement. And Weizmann's like, you're going to appoint this guy who's an outsider, doesn't get us, he's a nobody, he's useless, he's weak, you're going to appoint him as a vice president? Herzl says, yes. Why? I don't speak whatever language that is, but I translate it for you in English. He opens the portals of royalty to me. That was Herzl. Herzl was looking for access. And whoever and whatever could give him access, he would do it. Whether it meant Sir Francis Montefiore, whether it meant von Plev, whether it meant it didn't matter. He would meet with anyone, anywhere, anytime. If he thought that that could get him the access he needed to make an impact. Contrast that with a comment by Weizmann in 1907. He writes, in this again from his autobiography. He writes, the governments of the world will pay attention to us only when they become convinced that we are capable of conquering Palestine through persistent, practical work. In other words, it's not through your good graces. Now, the ironic part is that's ultimately how it happens. But it's not because some government just one day is going to wake up and say, you know, we feel bad for the Jews, we're going to give them access to the homeland. When they realize that we're a movement. And again, that's playing to the masses, because Weizmann appreciated the masses, Herzl was oblivious to the masses. What I want to do now, take your packet that I gave you. And I want to skim through. It's 10 pages. We're not reading all 10, don't worry. But it's all in English, so I copied more rather than less. These are all excerpts from Weizmann's autobiography called Trial and Error. And I want to share with you a few excerpts. The first page. And these are all obviously purposeful. First page is Weizmann describing the Zionist activities in Pinsk. So again, Pinsk was, he's still relatively young. And I want you to think about it in contrast to the modern organized Zionist movement that we attribute to Herzl. Okay? He writes here, page number one, where I have the arrow. We must not think of Zionism in Pinsk 50 odd years ago, long before the coming of Theodor Herzl, in terms of the modern movement. Organized activity in the present-day sense simply did not exist. A youth organization was undreamed of. There were casual meetings of the older people at which youngsters sneaked in to sit in the corner. On rare occasions when a circular was sent out, we were permitted to address the envelopes. Our financial resources were comically primitive. We dealt in rubles and kopecks. One of the main sources of income, .. On Purim, that's what they used to collect for. Okay? So again, it's primitive. It's disorganized. Now, why do I share? Why do I think that excerpt and the one on the next page, which I'm not going to read with you, you can read on your own. Why do I think those are important? Because it shows that Weizmann was part of the masses. He was part of this group. Page, the second page, I quote that on Saturday nights they used to sit in cafes and they would sit up till the wee hours of the morning debating Zionism. Herzl never did that. Herzl created Zionism in an ivory tower in Vienna. For Weizmann, it was part of him. It was real. It was living it. He was living and breathing it. Turn to page number 3. Oh, and apparently I have that. Oh yeah, name number 3. This is Weizmann's description of meeting Herzl. Every quote I give you from here on out is directed toward those 4 points. One of those 4 points. Of the difference between Weizmann and Herzl. And that's what I'm going to be pointing out the whole time. He writes here, I was in my second year in Berlin when in 1896, Theodor Herzl published his tract, now the classic, in Zionism, the Jewish State. It was an utterance which came like a bolt from the blue. We had never heard the name Herzl before. Think about it, it's crazy, right? We think of Herzl, the founder of Zionism. Weizmann, who was a prominent Zionist, had never heard the name Herzl until 1896. Herzl was on the scene for 8 years. Or perhaps it had come to our attention only to be lost among those other journalists and something else. Fundamentally, the Jewish state contained not a single new idea for us. That which so startled the Jewish bourgeoisie was called down the resentment and derision of the Western rabbis had long been a substance of our Zionist tradition. We observe, too, that the man Herzl made no allusion in his book to his predecessors. Right? Herzl had no historical awareness of what had preceded him. The underline, apparently Herzl did not know the existence of Chibat Zion. He did not mention Palestine. He ignored the Hebrew language. In other words, things that mattered to the masses meant nothing to Herzl. Yet the effect produced by the Jewish state was profound. Not the ideas, but the personality which stood behind them that appealed to us. Here was daring, clarity, and energy. The fact that this Westerner came to us unencumbered by our own preconceptions, had its appeal. We of the Russian group in Berlin were not alone in our response. Turn the page to page number 4. He describes his first meeting with Herzl. First full paragraph. I first saw Herzl at the Second Congress in Basel in the summer of 1898. And though he was impressive, I cannot pretend that I was swept off my feet. Right? He wasn't enamored by him. There was a great genuineness about him and a touch of pathos. It seemed to me almost from the beginning that he was undertaking a task of tremendous magnitude without adequate preparation. He had great gifts and he had connections, but these did not suffice. As I learned to know him better at succeeding congresses, my respect for him was confirmed and deepened. As a personality, he was both powerful and naive. He was powerful in the belief that he had been called by destiny to this piece of work. He was naive, as we already suspected from the Jewish state, and as we definitely learned from our contact with his work in his schematic approach to Zionism. Schematic approach, in other words, they had a fundamental disagreement about what the correct approach was and should be to accomplish their goals. Arrow, his Zionism began as a sort of philanthropy. Superior, of course, to the philanthropy of Baron de Hirsch, but philanthropy nonetheless. As he saw it or seemed to see it, there were rich Jews and there were poor Jews. Which is a nice way of saying there were Western European Jews and Eastern European Jews. The rich Jews who wanted to help the poor Jews had considerable influence in the Council of the Nations, Sultan of Turkey, etc. There were, again, two next paragraph. We'll skip to my underline. Young as I was and totally inexperienced in worldly matters, I considered the entire approach simplest and doomed to failure. To begin with, I had no faith at all in the rich Jews whom Herzl was courting. Right? Weizmann thinks he's wasting his time. He doesn't think all these quote-unquote prestigious political, governmental figures, these rich Jews, are going to actually accomplish anything. Top of the right-hand side, page 45, on top, with my arrow, to me, Zionism was something organic. It's organic. It's from the masses. It's not something that's decided in palaces, in offices. It's organic, which had to grow like a plant, had to be watched, watered, and nursed if it was to reach maturity. I did not believe that things could be done in a hurry. The Russian Zionists had as their slogan a saying of the Jewish stages, that which the intelligence cannot do, time will do. There was no lack of Zionist sentiment in the Russian Jewish masses. What they lacked was will, direction, organization, the feeling of realities. Herzl was an organizer. He was also an inspiring personality, but he was not of the people and did not grasp the nature of the forces which he harbored. That's such a striking term. He was not of the people. He was perceived as an outsider. He swooped in, created this infrastructure, but he didn't get what drove the masses. That sense of tradition, that sense of connection to Palestine, that desire to return to the homeland. All of that was completely lost on Herzl. Turn your page to page 5. This we're not going to read. You can read on your own, but it shows his disdain for Max Nordau. I'll just read a couple of underlines. Max Nordau, of course, a famous European figure. But what mattered to us was that he was an ardent Zionist only during the sessions of the Congresses. Because they didn't care that he could give speeches. I have at my house, if you ever want it. I have all the writings of Max Nordau. He was a great figure. But he was, right, only during the sessions of Congresses. By the way, I hope you appreciate, Weizmann does not mince words in his autobiography, right? Unimpressed with Herzl, blasting Nordau. He was not prepared, like Herzl and many others, to sacrifice his career for Zionism. Okay? Again, you can read the right side of the page on your own. Turn to page 6. These two pages, or three pages we're about to read, really captures that East versus West divide. Okay? He writes on the top right, left-hand side. We'll stop at start at the top of page 52. Of our battles against the disillusion of young Jewry in the Russian Revolution, I shall speak again. But enough has been told here to indicate one set of reasons for the opposition to Herzl, which took place in the democratic fraction at the early Zionist Congresses. And that was why Russian Jews opposed Herzl. We were not revolutionaries, but it would have been more accurate to call us reactionaries. We were a struggling group of young academicians without power and without outside support, but we had a definite outlook. We did not like the note of elegance and pseudo-worldliness which characterized official Zionism, the dress suits and the frock coats and flat and fashionable dresses. Right? In other words, the organizational Zionism, they felt, had sold out. They were living the lap of luxury. They were dressed a certain bourgeois way. That's not the masses. These Russians were living in poverty. They were living behind the pale. They didn't. These guys were aliens to them. On me, the formalization of the Zionist Congress made a painful impression, especially after one of my periodic visits to the wretched and oppressed Russian Jewish masses. Actually, it was all very modest, but to us it smacked of artificiality, extravagance, and something else. Okay? What? Hodmond? I don't know. Again, I'm not.
High world.
Mm-hmm. Next paragraph. Had we been other than we were, we could not have appealed to the student youth, which was later to constitute the leadership of the Zionist movement. Herzl had no access to it. The youth. He did not speak its language, just as both figuratively and literally, he did not speak the language of Russian Jewish masses. He did not speak the language. Next paragraph, where I have my arrow. There were other related reasons for our opposition. Herzl's pursuit of great men, of princes and rulers who were to give us Palestine was the pursuit of a mirage. It was accompanied most unfortunately, but perhaps inevitably, by a shift of the leadership to the right. Herzl played to the rich and powerful, to Jewish bankers and financiers, to the Grand Duke of Baden, of Kaiser Wilhelm, to the Sultan of Turkey, later the British Foreign Secretary. We, on the other hand, had little faith in the benevolence of the mighty. Next paragraph. A third set of reasons came into play. Herzl, as we have seen, relied on diplomatic activity to get Palestine for the Jews. Just go to the right-hand side where I have that underline. Herzl did not know Russian Jewry, neither did the Westerners who joined them. Herzl, in his biography, writes the following about the first Congress, where I have my double arrow on the right-hand side. And there rose before our eyes a Russian Jewry, the strength of which we had not even suspected. Right? And again, he didn't know. He didn't know about these Jewish masses that have been talking about at their cafes and dinner tables about Zionism. 70 of our delegates came from Russia, and it was patent to all of us that they represented the views and sentiments of the 5 million Jews of that country. And what a humiliation for us, who had taken our superiority for granted. Herzl realizes now that he might not have the full picture. But then, he nonetheless, in the next paragraph, Herzl says they possess the inner unity which has disappeared from among the Westerners. They are steeped in Jewish national sentiment, though without betraying any national narrowness and intolerance. They are not tortured by the idea of assimilation. Their essential being is simple and unshattered. They do not assimilate into other nations, but they exert themselves to learn the best that there is in other peoples. In this wise, they manage to remain erect and genuine. And yet, they are ghetto Jews, the only ghetto Jews of our time. Looking on them, we understood where our forefathers got the strength to endure through the bitterest times. And Weizmann says, yet with all this intuitive perception, this generosity of understanding, Herzl cannot remake his own approach to Zionism. Right? Herzl kind of got it intellectually, but he couldn't make that shift. Okay? If you look on page 7, we'll just finish this part up. He writes, I'll just read the underlines. We, the unhappy Jews of Russia, were to be sent to Palestine by them, the emancipated Westerners. And if Palestine was not available, well, some other territory would have to be found. We were vindicated in our attitude toward the Western leaders when, at the crucial moment in Zionist history, following the Kishinev pogrom, Herzl attempted to substitute Uganda for Palestine as a temporary palliative measure. He urged, failing to perceive that with all their suffering, the Jews of Russia were incapable of transferring their dreams and longings from the land of their forefathers to any other territory. It was thus made manifest that Palestine had in fact never been available to the Western leadership. It had been a mirage, and when the mirage faded, Uganda, which as a matter of fact was even more of a mirage, was proposed in its place. The fact that the heart of Jewry was fixed by every bond of affection and tradition on Palestine seemed beyond the understanding of the Westerners. The enormous practical significance of this fixation is unique and quite irreplaceable power to awaken the energies of the Jewish people escaped them. We liked and admired Herzl and knew that he was a force in Israel, but we opposed him within the movement because we felt that the Jewish masses needed something more than high diplomatic representatives, that it was not good enough to have two or three men traveling around interviewing the great of the world on our behalf. Okay? And that those five lines, to me, really captures the essence of the East-West divide. The other clips you can read on your own. And again, I encourage you strongly, if you're interested by these excerpts that I quoted, to read his autobiography. It is absolutely fascinating. We'll just read one more on page 9. Page 9, I have the arrow, that bottom left-hand side. He writes, how is it that Herzl can contemplate such a shift in objective? It was the logical consequence, in other words, from Palestine to Uganda. He says it was the logical consequence of his conception of Zionism and of the role which the movement had to play in the life of Jews. To him, and to many with him, Zionism meant an immediate solution of the problems besetting their sorely tried people. If it was not that, it was nothing at all. The conception was at once crude, naive, and generous. For Herzl, Zionism was one thing. It was a practical solution. And if it couldn't accomplish that, again, this is in the wake of Kishinev, then there was no point in having Zionism anymore, which is why Herzl forced the Uganda plan. And again, obviously, he fundamentally disagrees with that. Okay? Yeah. Yeah.
So there was actually
Aliyah
going on?
Yeah, of course. Herzl was, if one thing I've communicated, Herzl was late to the party. That's we don't appreciate that. Because you talk about Herzl as the founder of Zionism. You talk about Herzl was late to the game. Herzl was the founder of the Zionist movement as an organized diplomatic movement. He was not the founder of Zionism. Zionism had been festering at coffee tables and dinner tables for the previous century, the entire 19th century.
When did the
Bihu
come?
1882. 1882, I don't know. Yes?
Yes.
In Hearst's writing, I wouldn't expect to see. But in White's writing, I would expect to see some mention of the religious Zionist feeling of movement in his community.
No, so he does. Again, I'm not giving... Hold on. I'm not giving, obviously, the... It's a 400-page book. But Weizmann does speak about the religious component of the movement, both in a good sense and a negative sense. He definitely speaks, and one thing which I tried to give excerpts that drove to this was that it was the traditionalism of Russian Jews which made Uganda such a preposterous proposal. It was Weizmann's assimilation that made it a reasonable proposal. That's why, I remember, if you go back to the chart... Herzl, excuse me. If you go back to this, that's what I said, right? I when I drew the line between the two, it's the assimilation versus the traditional which lays the groundwork for the others. They had different approaches. They had different worldviews. Their dinner tables looked different. The conversation looked different. Their relationship to the Jewish people was different. Herzl even wrote that, if you caught it in the quote a couple pages ago, I was just about to say something, then I got distracted, but he made a comment which I thought was very interesting, where he says, he says that they're not tortured by the idea of assimilation when talking about Russian Jews, right? They're not tortured by assimilation. He lamented the fact that Western European Jews didn't have more of that innate traditional connection to Judaism and tradition as part of their kishkas.
Is Weizmann or Herzl?
That's Herzl. Herzl in his biography writes that.
That I understand.
No, so Weizmann speaks about, yeah. Weizmann, first of all, is very frustrated, hold on, when it comes to the Balfour Declaration. 1917, Weizmann writes in his autobiography, he's very frustrated at the lack of rabbinic support that he receives. He's, again, Eastern European rabbis, Zionism was a dirty word, which I spoke about a little bit in Shul on Shabbos. So he was very frustrated at the lack of support. And Eastern European rabbis it's because they weren't supportive of Zionism. Some were, the majority was not. And the reason why they were not was because of the assimilationist attitude of Herzl, the fact that Zionism was trying to create a state which was divorced from religion. But again, it was the traditional. You have to, it's like the cab driver in Israel. The cab driver in Israel, which is irreligious, but he has more emuna than I can ever have. It's because it's a part of him. It's part of his kishkas. There's a traditional upbringing that you can't take away from the person. You can't teach. That's what Weizmann had. And that Herzl was missing, at least in Weizmann's opinion. I'll just share with you one last quote. And again, this is from Herzl's speech at the Second Zionist Congress. And again, on the eve of our JNF Shabbaton, speaking about Zionism, speaking about the land of Israel, 1898. Listen to what Theodor Herzl said. No piece of land has been coveted by so many. And out of that passion, it remained desolate and destroyed. Right? How many countries had control over Israel for thousands of years? And it was a wasteland. It was a desert wasteland. Okay? But we believe that this desolate corner of the Orient has not only a past, but just as ourselves, also has a future. On this land where so little grows now, ideas for all of mankind have grown. And it is because of this that no one can deny that there is an indelible link between us and this land. And to think, Herzl said that in 1898, that this land which has nothing, we're going to make it flourish. We're going to turn it into something of ideas and a light into the nations. And to think that we sit 119 years later from the second Zionist, did I get the math right? 119 years later, from the Second Zionist Congress, and it's truly mind-boggling. And so to leave you with a little bit of that Zionist good feeling, I'll share with you a video that AIPAC showed at Policy Conference 2 years ago. It's a 2-minute video, but I think it really captures a lot of the excitement. And then we'll close up at the end. Talk about a rivalry, Herzl, Weizmann, they obviously disagree in approach, but to think and to reflect upon 120 years of the past of modern Jewish history, whatever their disagreements were, it is a tremendous blessing, it is a tremendous miracle that we have the modern state of Israel. And as we say, Kol machlokas l'shem shamayim. Herzl probably didn't know it was l'shem shamayim. But any machlokas that's l'shem shamayim, both wanted a homeland for the Jewish people. And Baruch Hashem, nowadays, we have a homeland, and how blessed we are. Everyone have a fantastic night.